This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get a preview of the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair, which starts today in Custer.
First, it's time for the final installment of our series on Walker's promises by the numbers. In 2010, Scott Walker told voters that if elected, he'd help Wisconsin add 250,000 private sector jobs in his first term. Based on numbers released yesterday, it's a promise the governor likely won't be able to keep. Sean Johnson breaks it down.
Part of what made Governor Walker's 250,000 jobs pledge memorable is that Walker went so big with the number. But the promise also endured because Walker kept talking about it. In December of 2010, even though the campaign was behind him, then-Governor-elect Walker gave a speech to the Dairy Business Association, where the promise was front and center.
The measure that I'll face in 4 years is not, you know, what press release did I put out and whether or not my ads are kind of cool or anything like that. The real measure would be, what did I do to create an environment to help create 250,000 new jobs in the state of Wisconsin, and were we successful or not?
The governor no longer brings up the 250,000 jobs promise on his own these days. Based on numbers released yesterday, it's easy to see why. Highly accurate quarterly data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showed Wisconsin had created just short of 92,000 jobs in Walker's first 3 years in office. Add preliminary numbers from the first 5 months of this year, and that total goes up to about 102,000. That's 148,000 jobs short of Walker's promise. Labor economist Laura Dresser with the Center on Wisconsin Strategies says it's not that 250,000 was a bad goal.
It was about the right number of jobs to pledge in terms of what would get us to 2007 levels of employment. So it's not a bad number. It turned out to be a bad guess.
University of Michigan labor economist Donald Grimes says the problem with any governor pledging to create jobs is that the economy is mostly outside of their control.
Is it ill-conceived to sort of make a promise that you can't really influence? I mean, I would say yes.
But it's not just that Walker stands to fall short of his own promise. Since the governor took office, private sector jobs have grown slower here than in all neighboring states and the nation as a whole. To put that in context, if private sector jobs had grown at the same rate in Wisconsin as they did nationally, Wisconsin would have added another 57,000 private sector jobs during Walker's time in office. Laura Dresser says that's significant.
Every time the national economy produced three jobs, the Wisconsin economy produced two.
Some economists think Walker's policies are partly to blame. University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee professor Mark Levine, who heads the Center for Economic Development, says Walker's repeated decisions to turn down federal money have cost the state jobs. He also thinks Walker's collective bargaining law slowed the recovery.
It took money out of the pockets of Wisconsin, a group of Wisconsin taxpayers to be sure, and had a kind of a de-stimulus effect on the overall economy.
North Star Economics CEO David Ward says that argument's not without merit, but he says 9 out of 10 workers are in the private sector, meaning most workers were not affected by Act 10. Ward, who's also an interim vice president for the University of Wisconsin, says what it comes down to is that the governor promised a big number, when in reality, Wisconsin's job growth has been kind of average.
When you put those kinds of numbers out there, you're assuming that things were going to get a lot better, a lot faster, and they didn't.
Economists say the state won't hit Walker's number by the end of his first term, but it might not hit it in a second term either. In fact, if growth continues at this rate, it would be early 2019 before the 250,000 jobs promise becomes reality. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This was the last installment in our three-piece series, book called Walker's Promises by the Numbers. You can find all of the pieces on our website at WPR.org.
Today kicks off the 25th annual Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer. Every year, the Midwest Renewable Energy Association gathers experts, exhibitors, and keynote speakers in central Wisconsin for an event centered on renewable energy education.
And we've got several guests with us for a preview of this year's festival. First up is Nick Hyla, the executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So it's the 25th annual fair. How have things changed over the years?
Oh, pretty significantly. You know, the Energy Fair started as an activist event, and we still have some of that, but we're always pushing the edge. But many of the things that were advocated 25 years ago are really large national industry and public and private sector interests. For example, the first fair, they put up a solar system, a pretty small solar system, and the cost at that time of the solar electric system was $84 a watt. Which is basically a measure of the size of the system as a watt. And today, that same system cost would be anywhere between, say, $1.80 and $4 a watt. So the price of some of the renewable energy technologies have fallen so significantly that that the entire environment has changed.
And interest in terms of the people who attend the fair, the crowd's been growing over the years?
The last few years, the crowds were down a little bit, and I think that was, you know, twofold. One, the economy was a little sluggish, and we really hadn't had a very favorable renewable policy climate in Wisconsin. But as of today, this year, we've had the busiest Friday in a long time, and we see a lot of renewed interest. You know, lots of business participation as we see kind of the growth in the renewable sectors, both in electric vehicles and solar electric and solar thermal systems, biodigesters. Generally, a lot of optimism right now about deployment of renewables, both in the residential and commercial space, and quite frankly, by the electric utilities themselves.
Okay, and a full slate of activities for the weekend. Hoping for good weather, I imagine?
Well, we lucked out. You know, last year we were hit by lightning a half hour before open and lost our phones and our credit card machines. And this year that same storm front looks to be over Michigan. So we have clear weather for the whole weekend, 80 degrees, a beautiful day, nice and cool night. So, yeah, we're really excited.
Bad for Michigan, good for us. Nick, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Nick Hyla, Executive Director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. Right now we turn to one of the fair's keynote speakers. He is Michael Noble, the Executive Director of Fresh Energy. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, you're going to be talking to this group about solar and wind energy, and you've been around the business for a while. In terms of where these industries are right now, are we at some sort of a critical point in the history of, I don't know if I want to call it alternative energy, but solar and wind?
I think that's exactly what we're hearing. 25 years is a long time for people to be gathering in a farm field in Custer, Wisconsin. But maybe the first year there were some Birkenstocks and some tie-dye, but now this is a big international business, and solar energy and wind energy is really inevitable now that it'll overtake coal and natural gas. In the next year or two or three, wind energy will be cheaper than what I like to call plain vanilla electricity on the electric system. Without any subsidies or without any incentives, wind power will be the cheapest way to make electricity. And solar energy will be about 4 or 5 years behind. But within the next decade, wind energy and solar energy will be the cheapest way you can make new electricity.
Now, are we talking cheap for utilities, or are we talking cheap for the average consumer who might want to put some panels on their house or something?
I think that a large industrial scale solar and wind is going to be lower cost more quickly, but solar energy is going to be economic on your own roof in the not too distant future. Wind energy already is a heck of a bargain. I've come from Minneapolis, St. Paul, and our large electric utility buys more wind power than any utility in the world, and they claim that wind energy has been pushing down electric rates for their customers. They would have been higher if they hadn't been buying wind power all these last 10 years.
Now, in terms of the amount of wind and solar being used in the electric market, where are we percentage-wise? Where do we start, say, like 10 years ago, and where are we today? And how do you see that graph changing?
You can answer that question worldwide or nationwide or in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is, 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, it was, very, very low single digits, maybe even less than 1% at the turn of the century. But now we're getting up, I think. My own electric bill in St. Paul, Minnesota, is about 16% wind power now, and some utilities are pushing the envelope. On June 9th in Germany, half of all the electricity for a few hours in Germany was generated by solar power. 50.2% or something was coming from solar electric panels on the homes and businesses of the people who live in Germany. That just proves that the industry has a really enormous future, both solar power and wind power, and we're just getting a roll on right now.
So in terms of opposition, though, who is opposing this? I mean, are we talking about traditional energy producers, or is it just a political thing, or what?
Well, both, I guess, is the answer. I'm going to mention tomorrow that over on $900 million is spent annually in America to fight the notion that we have a serious problem with our climate. About $900 million in shady nonprofit and corporate contributions where you can't even necessarily track where these contributions come from. Is being spent to keep the American people confused about whether we have an energy problem, whether we have a climate problem or not. So the old way is dying, but it's going down slow and hard and fighting. Wisconsin, unfortunately, is falling behind the neighboring states. Iowa and Michigan and Minnesota and Illinois are all dramatically ahead of Wisconsin on clean energy. And I think eventually consumers and businesses and customers of electric utilities will realize that not only is Wisconsin missing out on the jobs, but it's missing out on the stable, low-cost electricity that solar and wind can provide.
Well, Michael, we're out of time, but thanks so much for being with us.
I'm appreciative of your taking my call today.
That's Michael Noble, the Executive Director of Fresh Energy.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're continuing our look at this year's Midwest Renewable Energy Fair with a talk with another keynote speaker. George Seaman is with us. He is a founding farmer and CEO for Organic Valley. George, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks. Great to be here.
I want to talk a little bit about your work before we get into the message that you're going to be bringing to the fair this year. You know, looking back at the work you were doing with Crop back in the late 80s and then sort of where you are now, are you sort of surprised at where you wound up, or is this something that it makes perfect sense to you?
Oh, we're more than surprised. You know, Crop Cooperative was started as a farmer cooperative with the idea to see if we could use organic marketing to make farming viable and sustainable, and we really set out to do what we thought was the right thing, and we had no idea we would succeed, no less become a billion-dollar farmer co-op that's the biggest co-op in the United States of organics. So, oh, sure, we're really surprised and very happy to be able to be where we're at today.
So given all of that, what's the message that you are taking to the people who are attending the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair this weekend?
Well, you know, it's great. We just are celebrating our 26th year. They're celebrating their 25th year, and it's really a great perspective to look back and see how much when we were just beginning, how much we were on the outside looking in, and now we're the future, and it's becoming more and more obvious, and we share so much of common values, and it's just something where we need to join each other's movement, so to speak, and we support renewable energy, and we need them to support organic food, and it's all part of a sustainable future.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that. How does organic farming fit into that idea of renewable energy, of a sustainable future?
Yeah. Well, you know, once you get by, you know, not using all the pesticides and herbicides and all that, you know, organic farming is a much better carbon sequestration because of all the soil tilth and the roots and the pasture basedness to it. And there's just a lot of benefits from organics to the environment. And of course, there's also benefits to the health of the people. So it's a complex thing, organic SIDS, but it's a viable system, and it answers a lot of the problems we have in our society today.
Would you say that it's more of the mainstream now than it was then when you started? I mean, certainly there are plenty of high-end stores where you can buy organics, you can get them almost everywhere, but yeah. is it fully integrated, or is it still kind of an outlier in some ways?
Well, organics is very much in all parts of our society today. It's amazing. You know, it's 60-70% of the people buy one organic high and the other, is what the polls say. Organic milk today, the drinking milk, is 7.9% of all fluid milk sold in the United States. And you're finding it in all the major chains. And so organics is an important part of the grocery market. In many stores, it's the only part that's really growing. So it's very important to the grocers. And the biggest indication you see of that is the real focus that Costco and Target and Walmarts are doing to kind of compete with the food co-ops and the Whole Foods and all the other chains that have been carrying organic food for a while.
Yeah, and on the supply side of things, there's been a shift too, at least looking around Wisconsin. A lot back in the 70s and 80s, you know, lots of traditional farming, if you want to call it that. The return to organics calls for a difference in philosophy on the part of suppliers as well.
Yeah, it's been a real gift to the family farms of Wisconsin to be able to, a real lifeline to organics has made the traditional Wisconsin farms be viable, and certainly you can see that people are going organic or getting bigger as a trend in Wisconsin. We are lagging behind in transition. We need more support from the government that we don't get, and you know, in general, our ag policies favor the conventional chemical agriculture, and so we struggle to get enough transition acres, and our co-op takes the lead on a lot of that to get more people transitioning to organics.
So as you look at the future of your business and of organics in general, is it able to grow fast enough to meet demand, or are those things sort of pacing nicely with each other?
Overall, they're pacing nicely. There's nobody really stimulating the acres like we'd like to see, as I just said. So right now we're seeing a growth rate of 10%, and that's a healthy growth rate for business our size. The industry's growing about that rate. And you're seeing a lot more imported organics, which while some people might debate that, it's good for those people going that way versus the chemical ag route. But also there's organic acres out there that are coming towards this United States. So I think it's a healthy balance. Of course, I'm an organic advocate, and I'd like to see more. But if you compare the last 25 years where the renewable energy movement's gone and where we've gone, you really have to say things have really changed.
And, you know, organic is one of those words that is tossed around a lot, and sometimes people don't always know what they're saying. You, I know, have played a significant role in creating some of the USDA standards for organic foods. But when you're talking to people, how do you define organic, and how do you hear it maybe used inappropriately sometimes?
Yeah, well, organics has two meanings. One is it's a third-party verified USDA organic standard of how food is produced. And it's produced without with practices that are required, and it's produced without prohibited materials. And so it's rare that you have a third-party verified food system that answers so many concerns like pasturing and humane care and the use of chemicals and that kind of thing. So that's kind of the regulatory label definition. For a farmer, organics is all about working with nature, trying to not fight nature, but to figure out what works best on their farm and what works best in the system they have. And so it really gives permission to farmers to think for themselves. And we've got some great successes in Wisconsin with farmers getting state average yields and buying very little inputs and succeeding in this modern day.
Now, you've had some big success at Organic Valley, and the industry as a whole has grown so much. Is this an important time for organics, or do you just see any kind of turning point, or do you just see things sort of continuing to grow at a predictable rate?
Well, this embracing, and I don't want to say that all retailers are important, but this embracing that you're seeing by the Walmart and Costco's and the big chains is pretty significant, because you keep, every time you go into a new marketplace, you bring in a new group of consumers, because consumers tend to be loyal to their stores and convenience and that kind of thing. So we're seeing a surge now, and the volume in those stores is really, really telling. So the industry, the market's kind of divided in two parts, the natural foods people who we're very loyal to, and then these bigger players that are bringing a whole new group of consumers in. So I'm very hopeful when you look at the educated young people, especially the educated females and young mothers, and how their focus is that, you know, with children, with mothers having less children all the time, you're seeing more and more concern about these issues. So I think organics has got a lot of growth potential still.
Well, George, thanks so much for being with us today.
All right. Thank you.
We've been talking with George Seaman. He is the founding farmer and CEO for Organic Valley.
And he's speaking at this weekend's Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, Wisconsin.
This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. Lori Skelton joins us to share her experiences using a new and unusual ingredient in classic desserts.
First, though, documents released yesterday indicate that prosecutors in a John Doe investigation believe that Governor Scott Walker was orchestrating a sweeping fundraising and spending effort to help him and other Republicans survive the 2011 and 2012 recall elections.
Those documents have kicked off a heated round of reaction across the political spectrum and captured some national attention as well.
And with us to discuss this is Daniel Bice, a political columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he writes the Watchdog column. Thanks for joining us today, Daniel.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. I want to start out. The documents yesterday, of course, indicate that prosecutors suspected Governor Walker and maybe some of his colleagues of orchestrating an illegal fundraising effort. In your estimation, as someone who has not just been following the story but working on it, what was the big news from yesterday? And beyond being interesting or titillating, what's its value?
There was a complaint filed, by one of the targets in this case back in February, trying to stop the investigation. And most of the complaint had been made public, and other elements of this have been made public. What was new yesterday was the prosecutor's response. The prosecutors responded by saying, "We think we had a legitimate case. We were asking for subpoenas, and we are pursuing this case for a particular reason." But when they filed this back earlier this year, their response was completely redacted. So we had no idea the outline of their case. Yesterday, the judge opened up that entire document so we could see for the first time what they thought was going on during the 2011 and 2012 recall elections.
And so in that outline, the case, the document seemed to point directly at Governor Walker.
They pointed at three individuals. They pointed at Governor Walker and his chief campaign strategist, R.J. Johnson. R.J. has been a prominent Republican strategist in Wisconsin for 20, 25 years. And Johnson's top deputy, Deb Jordahl. Those were the three people identified. And then it also identified a couple of other organizations, including Governor Walker's campaign fund. And the point was they were arguing that there was a massive system to do a coordinated campaign in terms of fundraising during the recall elections. The prosecutors thought that what they were trying to do was illegal, that it would cover up the sources of the money that was being spent, and it involved as many as 12, maybe even more, conservative groups, and money would be shuffled among those groups. And when those groups would then do their get out the vote efforts, or when they were advertised on TV, you would see their names, but you wouldn't know who was actually behind it. Now, the targets, specifically Wisconsin Club for Growth, felt like what they did was perfectly legal. The response so far has not been to argue that this was not going on, as the prosecutors were suggesting. The argument is that what they did was not illegal.
And it's interesting, too. There was a flowchart that I encourage people to take a look at, published in the Journal Sentinel today, that outlines some of the complexity of this whole thing. And that's, you know, really for people who are trying to follow this, who aren't really following politics that closely, this is right. confusing territory.
It is. I mean, even if you are following it, you know, last night when we were putting the chart together, I was trying to make sure all of the numbers were right and all of the groups were right. And, you know, the only familiarity some people would have with a few of these groups is that they ran ads. The Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Issues Mobilization, Inc. ran ads, but you know, the people don't know much about that organization. But the key parts are that the governor and his main strategists are at the center of this thing to shift all this money around. It is a quite complex scheme, as the prosecutor said, or effort that was put together by the various individuals in this.
And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the governor's reaction. Yesterday, in a piece that you published, the governor was unflappable on the campaign trail. Today, though, it appears as though he may have gone on the offensive a bit. We saw him on Fox Friday or Fox and Friends this morning, heard him on some Milwaukee radio this morning, and there was an opinion piece published this afternoon.
Sure. And just for a little bit of context, this is a John Doe investigation, which is a secret, supposedly secret, not secret anymore, but a supposedly secret investigation in which they can compel testimony and all of these. And there was one John Doe investigation that was launched in 2010. And the governor, during the first John Doe, remained largely silent and at one point said that he trusted the prosecutors to do the right thing, that he knew them and thought that they would do the correct thing. And he wasn't charged. He had a couple aides who were charged and convicted, but he wasn't affected. Now, during this John Doe, which started in August 2012, and it became public in a piece that I wrote in October of 2013, the governor has said repeatedly that he can't talk about the investigation because anybody involved in it would violate the secrecy order to discuss this. Well, this all changed yesterday after the release of the records and the news of what they were looking at specifically. The governor talked to the media and he pointed out that two judges have found that the case laid out by the prosecutors was inadequate or out of bounds. And then today, he's gone very much on the offensive. They bought $250,000 in TV ads that are airing throughout the state, Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay, and elsewhere, starting today. And then he was tweeting last night repeatedly on this subject. He was on talk radio in Milwaukee, and he's written a column on the thing, and he's gone on national TV with Fox and Friends. So this is a full frontal response to what is going on.
Well, thanks so much for your time. We'll have to leave it there, Daniel.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
We've been talking to Daniel Bice, a political columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he writes the Watchdog column. This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Time now for Food Friday. This week, we've got a special treat for you.
We tasked our own Lori Skelton with a huge food experiment. We asked her to incorporate a mystery ingredient into some desserts.
Lori joins us to share her experiences and advice. She's one of WPR's in-house foodies and a classical music host. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
It is a great pleasure to be here.
Well, you've been making desserts for the WPR staff for a few weeks now. We knew here on Central Time what the secret ingredient was, but it was a mystery to everyone else. Tell us about your mystery ingredient.
What we were using in brownies and cheesecake and cake frosting and sauce for ice cream was miso.
Miso. Now, I only discovered miso a little while back in my life. Give us miso 101. What is it?
This is a Japanese condiment, for want of a better word. You combine soybeans and grain, usually rice, but sometimes something like a barley or a millet, sea salt, and you let this ferment. You let it sit in a barrel, talk to itself for a little while. What you end up with is a very powerful, salty, umami paste. In Japan, it's used for sauces, for dipping vegetables in. It's very, very good for marinating fish. I don't know if you've ever had a miso marinated cod.
I have not.
But it shows up in restaurants more and more around the country. There's one restaurant here in Madison. It's one of their signature dishes, and I just love it.
So the miso we get, that we don't have to ferment our own. We can go buy. I've bought this. You just buy a bucket of glop.
It looks exactly like that, a bucket or a bag of glop. Miso comes in varying strengths, and it's usually referred to by the color. The palest is called a white miso. Get a little bit stronger, yellow or brown. The strongest, which is going to taste almost beefy, is referred to as a red miso. As you get stronger, you're also getting saltier. I started using miso a little over a year ago when it was suggested that it be used as part of a vinaigrette for a particular vegetable salad. And it's now become my go-to salad dressing, ginger and miso and a little bit of oil and vinegar, and it's amazing.
You've said a lot of foods that miso could be used in, but what you're trying here is miso in dessert. Where'd that come from?
I was given an article that was published in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago, and the idea here is if you've ever played with salted caramel in desserts, a lot of people are really enjoying the idea of sweet is more than just sweet. There are levels of flavor to it. You can add salt. You can add umami to chocolate or to things with cream. Sometimes, for instance, raspberries with balsamic vinegar. Sometimes you want a more savory element with fruit. And this particular article in the Wall Street Journal was saying, go miso on all of this. I must admit, as much as I love umami flavors, I was a little bit skeptical, so I thought this would be a great thing to try out with all of the different people at Wisconsin Public Radio, get a lot of different tastes involved, and see if this really does work.
So you put on your mad scientist coat, went into the Laurie Skelton Laboratory, and the first thing that emerged were the brownies. I've been able to taste all of these as you've done them. So the brownies, I'll say, I think were my second favorite of the bunch. I thought it worked well. Tell us about the miso in the brownies.
Well, here you had some leeway with the brownie recipe. Most of the recipes that I was looking at said use the mildest miso possible. The brownies, we were talking bittersweet chocolate and a lot of it, and it was suggested that you could go a little bit stronger miso. In retrospect, I think that was the wrong way to go. Most people found the umami brownies pleasant. Some people said tangy, and while it was a good flavor, I thought, it definitely took the gooey, gooey sweetness out of the mix. But some people really, really miss that. I don't know as I would use this particular brownie recipe as my go-to recipe for a brownie. But where I would love to try it is if I knew I was making a pan of brownies to use as the base for a brownie sundae. You've got this lovely, complex flavor, not too sweet, even though the chocolate is still there. And these brownies baked up more of a cake rather than something a little gooier. So this would be a great base to soak up ice cream and sauces and whatever you want to throw on top.
Okay, experiment number two, a box chocolate cake, and then the buttercream frosting had miso in it, right?
Right. Here I thought, okay, if miso is an element in your desserts, sometimes you just don't have time to do things from scratch, but you want a basic box cake to taste a little bit better than a basic box cake. And here I found a good basic buttercream frosting. I tried it two different ways. The first time it was just butter and sugar and miso, and that came out a little too thin, I thought, for a cake. I did, however, try that sweeter miso butter on muffins the next day straight out of the oven. Oh, heavens, that was tasty.
Okay, I didn't get to try that one, but that's okay.
Let's put it this way. I ate the whole batch.
It didn't survive.
It didn't make it out of my kitchen. It was really, really good. So thicker buttercream, one that you'd actually add eggs to and a few other ingredients. This one held up pretty well with the miso. The texture came out a little grainy, so you're probably going to have to play with how long you actually beat it in your mixer. But this was one that people thought, okay, I'm still getting this tangy, I'm still getting this kind of an aftertaste that I'm not quite sure I like, but it definitely took the bitterness out of that box cake. It definitely made the box cake taste better.
That's the one where it was what I expected. I thought if you add miso to a dessert, it's going to taste salty. I thought the frosting tasted kind of salty. It wasn't quite, I don't know, it was weird to have salty frosting.
Well, the one thing that we don't quite know how to work with on a Western palate is this is fermented. I've gotten to love making kimchi, but that's a fermented condiment that I'm still learning how to use. And I think we've got the same element here. Because this is a fermented food, there are going to be flavors that we're just not used to. And I definitely was picking that up as I was working through these recipes.
Well, now we're all used to sauerkraut on our brats. We get our fermentation
yes,
in there a little bit.
But when was the last time you put sauerkraut in a red velvet cake?
Never. Okay, and now we're moving back up on my ranking list to the last couple. A cheesecake, raspberry puree, I think it was. And then where did the miso go into that one?
Miso went right into the body of the cheesecake along with all of the cream cheese and the sugar. Now, cheesecake is wonderful, but it can be a little bit heavy. And in using raspberry puree mixed all the way through the batter, you would have had the sweet element, but it still would have been heavy. By adding the miso, you lightened the cream cheese mixture so that the texture in your mouth was not leaden, but the flavor complexity was really starting to build with that. Again, you're working off some of the sugar versus the salt. Mm-hmm. You've got the fruit in it, which, you know, you don't normally think of salting raspberries, but it really was pleasant. It made the raspberries taste brighter. And again, normally for something like that, you'd be adding more sugar. This cheesecake had less than a cup of sugar in it. I was really impressed.
Okay. And what was the response? I mean, you heard my response. I liked it.
Most people, again, not everybody was thrilled with this. The word tangy kept coming up. Everybody was asking.
I don't see that.
When I hadn't revealed the secret ingredient, people were thinking sour cream, goat cheese. Did you use vinegar? Somebody asked me.
What?
I'm not going to make this my go-to recipe for a cheesecake, but if I know that I'm going to be making a cheesecake, say that's going to be part of a dessert buffet where there's going to be lots of different sweet things, the idea that this is lighter in texture but still delivers a great amount of flavor would make this an option.
And now the winner, my favorite, you just brought in, and this is the easiest one to make, it sounds like, a butterscotch sauce with miso in it. We just put that on some ice cream. You cut up some bananas for us. Tell us about the butterscotch sauce.
A good caramel has, again, those complex layers of flavor. But making caramel at home can be a little bit daunting. This gave you all of the complex flavors that caramel has, but this was so easy. You whisk a little cream and butter in a saucepan until everything melts, throw in some miso and a little brown sugar, whisk it for 10 minutes, and you've got something that would just make anything, again, ice cream, bananas. Somebody wants me to try it on cherries. It just sang. It was so lovely.
And we're posting this one over at the Central Time Facebook page. It's easy to make at home.
So it came together in less than 20 minutes, and you've got something, again, the salt, here the tangy was taken out of it, but you've still got that salt, you've still got that umami. It's exciting to eat it.
And did everyone else like it as much as I did?
Absolutely. This was the clear winner. Nobody had anything bad to say about this.
So were people's jaws dropping on any of these when you told them when they found out it had been miso all
along? Everybody was stunned, especially people who don't normally think of anything Japanese moving onto an American table. It was a really great mix in a lot of different ways.
So any lessons learned here that you want to experiment with in the future or apply to future desserts?
If you are going to be using miso in desserts, definitely stick with what is called shiro miso or white miso.
That's the mellower
this
one.
This is the mildest one there is. And go slowly. You can always add more. Mm-hmm. But this is a flavor that if you add too much, you're not going to be able to dial it back. So if you've got a recipe or you've got a suggestion, I would say start with maybe 3/4 of what the recipe calls for, and then if you want a little bit more, bump it up.
And do you dissolve the miso in water first and then pour it into a batter, or just take the glop and stir it in?
Glop it right in.
All right. So you give the thumbs up overall. Miso in dessert, it has a place.
It's definitely an element to play with. Again, I wouldn't call it the go-to, but if you want to change things up in the kitchen, this would be a great place to start.
And that's a great place to leave it. Lori, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies. You can find her recipe for miso butterscotch sauce on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're checking it out, maybe suggest a new mystery surprise ingredient that she can try out. Gene, anything you want to see make its way into an unexpected place in the food world?
No, I'm going to say I'm very open to almost anything, because the weeks when Lori is working on these experiments around Wisconsin Public Radio, it's a great place to be.
Yeah, we get to be the lab, the testers.
Yeah, we're the lab, so suggest away. Post some suggestions on the Central Time Facebook page, and we will be happy to be the in-house testers for you.
And Gene, with all the cooking you do, you're gonna start putting miso in virtually everything you cook, right? And statistically, I'm right.
A glop. I'm going to be putting glop in everything I cook.
In the zero things you cook, all will have miso.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.